The other day I was talking on the phone with a friend who's been spending a lot of time alone. But forget the pity, he's not very stressed. He was sitting on his boat docked in Key West. Did somebody say West? Hey, this is Spectrum West. I'm Al Ross, hopscotching into your day with news, views, and personalities engaged in the abundant arts, culture, and humanities in Western Wisconsin. This week, we're going to have a comfortable, intelligent conversation about who we are and what's affecting us. A session on sociology with Peter Hart Brinson of the UW Eau Claire faculty. We're going to talk about voting, the historic struggle for women's right to vote during the Women's History Month, which features a theatrical reading that remembers the women who did the work, and we'll meet an organization whose mission is helping people exercise this precious right. And let's begin at the beginning. Leave it to the Red Cedar Symphony Orchestra to remind us that a new season, the one called Spring, arguably the most anticipated of our seasonal quartet, is on the horizon. They use the word in the title of their next concerts, even though they're happening a couple weeks before we make spring official. Thank you, RCSO. Let's see what they're up to in a call to Ann Hansen. She's the board secretary. Let's talk about your fall concerts. They were the first live events in quite a while, and as it turned out, they helped you develop your resiliency because they were not without issues. Tell our audience some of what you had to endure and adjust to. You had a couple of different venues. You had replacement musicians. You had no intermission. Your soloist was an issue. Tell us about that concert and how you guys made it through those two.
Yes, our personnel director, Patty Smith, I remember her remarking, in all the years she's managed this orchestra, this was probably the most difficult concert cycle she's been through. In September, everybody thought we were just about through the pandemic. We start rehearsing, and everybody's starting to worry again. And, you know, we had a lot of discussions at board meetings about masking protocols and how we were going to make that work. And we finally decided that we don't own these venues. They're both churches. They are so wonderful to us as an orchestra hosting us. And we said, what they say goes. You follow their rules if it's their place. And so that was solved. But some musicians moved on during the pandemic. Some didn't wish to play with a masked orchestra. So we had to find replacements. Then we didn't have anybody who would move the percussion instruments for us. That was kind of the big adventure. We have to take them all from Rice Lake to the other venue. In this case, that was Cumberland. Usually we rent a U-Haul. And so we said, okay, anybody who's got a big car, show up at Bethany Lutheran in Rice Lake and we'll move those percussion instruments. And there's a lot of them, you know, and they're big and they're clumsy. We stuffed them all into cars and drove them out to Cumberland and then stuffed them all back in the cars afterward and drove them back to Rice Lake.
Wow.
We made it go.
That's what keeps your organization going strong. People working together, the volunteers, and you really didn't realize you were going to have to do it at such a level.
A lot of the musicians have been with this group for quite a long time now. It's kind of your friends, your tribe. We do have this thing going, this music thing going that's quite wonderful and very unusual.
Wonderfully unusual. So good for you. Did you touch on the soloist? What happened there?
Poor Mara Schack. She's our vocalist. She's got a wonderful voice. She's from Rice Lake. She was taken ill the week of the concert. But she has come back for these upcoming concerts and will be performing the spirituals. They are moving pieces of work.
I love the story about moving the large percussion instruments because it segues into the fact you also are proud owners of some nice, shiny new drums, timpani. That's been kind of a long process, hasn't it?
Several years ago, it became apparent. Most of our percussion equipment was aging. We were missing a lot of things that it would be nice to have. We had things like sponsor an instrument at concert intermissions and special mailings and things like that. And people really responded. Percussion instruments are not cheap. I can't remember the exact figure, but we probably raised in the neighborhood of $30,000 and we have gotten everything we wanted. It's been just amazing.
In your brochure, you are always looking for musicians, aren't you?
We are always looking for musicians, particularly strings players. You always need strings players. Different orchestral pieces of music are written with different combinations of brass, woodwinds, percussion, things like that. So you never quite know how many of those musicians you'll need for each concert. It depends on what's programmed by our conductor, Ivar Lunde. But we can always use more, and any strings musicians. They're thin on the ground in northwestern Wisconsin.
Executive director, too. You're looking for one of those. You won't have a problem. finding one eventually, and a good one, I'm sure, because you've had some good ones.
We have. We are an entirely nonprofit organization, so it's not like we're offering a large salary for this position. I think it would be ideal for somebody in retirement who was a musician, loved music, and, you know, was just looking for something to do. It's a very part-time job, really. Mm-hmm. If anybody listening is interested, give us a call.
We're on the phone with Ann Hansen, and we're talking about the Red Cedar Symphony Orchestra. Ann is a member of the board, the secretary, and she handles a lot of the publicity. Now we're going to tap into that publicity job, Anne, and ask you about the spring concerts. It's not officially spring, but I encourage everyone to use the word spring as often as they feel like it. It might have an effect on its arrival. That's what I'm hoping anyway. So tell us about what's coming up on your spring concerts. You have two of them, Saturday and Sunday, March 5th and 6th.
We are playing on Saturday evening at Chautauqua Lutheran Church. The concert starts at 7 o'clock, and then we play on Sunday afternoon at 4 p.m. at Bethany Lutheran Church in Rice Lake. And I really want to emphasize this concert is going to be really a lot of fun. I think young people would really enjoy it. And if you're 21 or younger, you get in for free.
That's always a wonderful amenity that comes along with the Red Cedar Symphony Orchestra. You maintain that. Good for you.
This is a formal part of our mission. Part of keeping classical music alive in an area like this is to keep the young people coming and interested.
So the Saturday evening and Sunday afternoon concerts on March 5th and 6th are called Adventures and Travels. That's an interesting title. Tell us what we can expect.
Well, Ivar Lunde not only programs the music, he also names the concerts. Mm-hmm. And this one, I think, very appropriately, we are playing pieces that sound like the parts of the world the composer was thinking of. So we have Africa, a fantasy for piano and orchestra, written by Camille Saint-Saëns. As Ivar remarked at one of the rehearsals, in this music, you can almost smell the camels. It sounds like the desert. It's lovely. We also have Hoedown, a cowboy dance, basically, from Aaron Copland's ballet Rodeo. Once again, you feel like you're there. You can hear the cowboys stamping, and it's very Western sounding. Mm-hmm. We have Tales from the Vienna Woods, which I think most people will recognize, even if they don't know the name. And that was written by Johann Strauss. It's a waltz. It's got a very long introduction where the sun has to come up in the woods and things like that. That's lovely. And then we'll have Mara Schock, of course, on the vocals, which are out of the American South, African-American spiritual. The Symphony in B minor by Franz Schubert is not really attached to any particular physical place. And I asked Ivar Lunde, how is that part of a travel and adventure? And his reply was, this is a travel into your soul. At rehearsal yesterday, he said, what do you think of when you're playing this piece? And somebody said, it's like he's arguing with himself. And it is. It's the sort of thing that might come into your head if you're a really good composer when you're laying awake at night, you know, just turning everything over in your mind. Because there's these lovely melodic phrases which alternate with this really ominous sounding stuff. It's quite an extraordinary piece.
And you did a wonderful job of explaining it. Knowing Ivar, I think I am going to refrain from talking to him for a while because I'm sure he's going to be boasting about that Norwegian Winter Olympics team. They won the most medals while they were there. And all the stuff that we've talked about, if you want more information about it, including how to become a volunteer or how to bring your musical talent to the Red Cedar Symphony Orchestra, can be found via the website redcedarsymphony.org. Ann Hansen, as always, a wealth of information. Have fun in your spring concerts. Hopefully we'll talk to you before your summer deal in the park. That's always fun to do. Ann, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much for having me, Al.
Just a little bit of that Copland Hoedown piece. I knew after hearing the title that it sounded familiar, and this is familiar. I think it's been used in commercials and stuff. You know? Spectrum West on WPR. Good to have you along this week. The right to vote is the foundation of democracy. It took a lot of work for women to gain that right. We have a couple conversations this week designed to highlight our regional approach to the preservation of this coveted entitlement, beginning with a special event at the Mabel Tainter in Menominee. It's designed to remember the quest for the 19th Amendment. Eau Claire Women in Theater, represented today by Debbie Brown, and the League of Women Voters, Greater Chippewa Valley, represented by Anne Marie McClellan, are presenting Failure is Impossible as part of Women's History Month. I asked Equites Debbie Brown about emerging from the restrictions of a pandemic.
We're just so thrilled to get together to be able to perform at all. And we had this piece that we had been working on and did it virtually in 2020, mm-hmm. but it's just not quite the same as performing together on stage. So we're so happy that we're able to do that. And we've been revamping the script a little bit as we've been working together.
Did you use or have extra time? And if did you write? I'm kind of like a teacher here, wondering if you used your time wisely, Debbie.
Well, if you're my teacher, I would say yes, of course. Sure. I did. Okay. I studied every night. Yeah.
Good for you.
We've been exploring different things to do in different venues because everything was so up in the air. And we, like most people, work best with a deadline. So if once we have something scheduled and once we have a goal in sight, it's easier for us to start working together. But no, there's stuff on the horizon.
Good. Yeah. I should point out too, your website offers a variety of video entertainment. There's some nice production done there. I've become a fan of The Ugly Wolverine, which was kind of fun. Do you guys do all that video yourself? I mean, there's music and there's animation.
We're lucky to have Ann Pearson part of our group, and she is a techno whiz. And then we did, when we were performing, have someone come in to professionally record some of the stuff.
And of course, we're talking about Failure is Impossible. Anne Marie McClellan, the League of Women Voters, has Wisconsin roots, and this year it's 102 years old. Your chapter formed in 2017. There is, I'm sure, an awareness on the part of today's members of the battles that it took prior to August of 1920. And ironically, these 100 plus years later, the right to vote and the act of voting are again up against some new challenges. Tell us how the League, the Greater Chippewa Valley chapter, are meeting some of those challenges.
Al, we're trying to meet those challenges in a variety of ways. Through education, that's our biggest outreach right now. Voting and ability, especially absentee voting, is really being challenged. We had a nice forum on that, and that's on our website if anybody wants to go and listen to that. Yeah, it's constant. I mean, democracy is, they call it, not a spectator sport. You have to be involved, and I think that that's the lesson we have learned from studying the suffragettes, helping to understand them and get this performance together and the work that they did. We're kind of using them as models.
Wisconsin's almost always appearing on a list of a handful of states considered to be crucial in at least a few ways. How does the Greater Chippewa Valley, how do you work with other local or regional chapters and the state organization?
The state office is in Madison, and there's chapters all across the state. We all work together. If there's candidate forums, when you're talking about candidates in a congressional district, you're going to go across a number of different chapters. And we share information. Gerrymandering has been a big focus this past year, trying to get a process for fair maps in front of the legislature so that they could vote on it. And that's a continuing battle that we'll also focus on, as well as making sure that it's easy to get out there and vote.
That's the voice of Anne Marie McClellan. She's representing the League of Women Voters, the Greater Chippewa Valley chapter. Also on the phone is Debbie Brown, who is one of the originators of, it's called EQUIT, but it stands for Eau Claire Women in Theater. Give us a playwright's condensed description of Failure is Impossible. It's influential women times two. There are a couple parts, I believe, to it.
There are 10 suffragists who come back to life to convince a modern voter that it's important for her to go and vote, using the history of the movement to instill in her the need and the pride for women to go vote. So we have five women from the 19th century, Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton and some of those buddies. And then we have five that were active when the 19th Amendment finally passed. We get to experience more than one character on stage.
Kind of a history lesson for you. You must find the kinds of things that you have to do prior to writing things like this completely enlightening. Do you come to appreciate things that you might have been unaware of?
Oh, very much so. And I can't claim to have written this whole thing. Okay. We divided up the history and whichever section, we were drawn to, we did the research and decided which scenes, which quotes, which information we found fascinating. It could be 6 hours long for all the things that we found fascinating about these women and what they had to go through. But we reduced it to about 45 minutes. I'm ashamed, actually, that I didn't know as much about it as I should have. The audience will be enlightened as well.
Anne Marie, how did this collaboration, this show, come together? Failure is Impossible. Who reached out to whom, and how did it happen?
Well, it happened in 2019 as we were preparing for the centennial in 2020, and Margie Hageman, past president of the League, got together with, I don't know if she got together with you, Debbie?
Yeah, Kathleen Sullivan and I were both in on some of the initial meetings.
Our League, back as a fundraiser for 2020, published a suffragette calendar. So we learned about at least a dozen suffragettes that we put in our calendar. And so we were very interested in the lives of these women through our research, which is very similar to the research that Debbie has done, I imagine. Mm-hmm. And so we were going to do this play at the Rossbach Museum in Menominee, but then COVID happened. There was a lot of suffragist celebrations that were postponed in 2020 because of COVID. And we just talked about, the performance and decided we should do it this year. The Women's History Month just seems like the perfect time. We feel safe enough to do it in person at the Mabel Tainer Theater. It's very exciting to be able to do it in a dramatic reading like this in a historic theater.
I agree.
The audience is getting the easy way out on their history lesson, Debbie.
Yeah, that's right. Well, we're hoping it's fun as well.
It's an original play. It's called Failure is Impossible, playing on a couple of occasions. Thursday, March 3rd, as Anne Marie alluded, at the Mabel Tainter, and then again Tuesday, the 8th of March, at Peace Lutheran Church.
The Peace performance, that is for the Chippewa Valley Learning and Retirement.
It's easy to donate or attend with the rest of the crowd, but it's quite another deed to literally get involved and pour oneself into something. Thank you for pouring yourself into this. Anne Marie McClellan and Debbie Brown, thank you for being with us on WPR and Spectrum West. We look forward to the performance.
Can I add one thing?
No. Sure you can. Oh.
Thank you. About the performance, I just want to say it will be free for everyone in attendance, so people can just drop in. The doors open at 6 o'clock that evening, March 3rd. We're hoping to get a nice turnout, especially some young people. Maybe some parents might want to bring their children. It's a history lesson, but it's also a lesson in dedication and hard work, just being involved in your community and democracy.
You bet.
We'll have a little bit of a social afterwards so people can come up and make sure they're ready to register to vote in the April elections and kind of meet some more of the League people.
Anne Marie McClellan, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me on, Al.
Debbie, keep us posted on all those things you said you're working on.
I will. Thank you so much.
And again, a reminder, the March 8th performance is for members of Chippewa Valley Learning in Retirement, but this show's a good excuse for joining. Check out their website, cvlr.org. You're listening to Spectrum West. Now let's continue on this important cultural theme, voting and being an informed voter. As we were reminded in our last conversation, we owe it to our ancestors to exercise hard-fought rights in an effort to keep democracy going strong. I called a coordinator, Karen Voss, to learn more about Chippewa Valley Votes, an organization initiated to help. Chippewa Valley Votes. We are a nonpartisan, volunteer-based voter assistance effort working across three counties in west central Wisconsin, Chippewa, Dunn, and Eau Claire, seeking to register, educate, and advocate for voters during elections and beyond. going to talk about your history a little bit in a minute, but here's more of an explanation. Our purpose is to empower voters to participate in the small d democratic process. Our goals are remove barriers to voting and expand access to the ballot box, reduce confusion surrounding voting laws and rules, promote a culture of voting and civic engagement. The final little paragraph is to accomplish these goals, our volunteers will conduct voter outreach in venues such as libraries, campuses, nursing homes, homeless shelters, and county fairs. In doing so, our efforts focus on underserved voter groups such as homeless, students, low-income, elderly, ex-felons, and non-English speakers. We believe every voter should have a voice. Hear, hear for that statement.
Yes,
huh?
That's all the truth.
The worst thing a citizen can do is fail to vote.
Absolutely.
That original statement that I read at the beginning, it had a little caveat in the last line, advocate for voters during the 2018 elections and beyond. So that kind of gives me an idea of your history. It appears you've been around, what, since then?
That's right. We started just a few very interested people in the latter part of 2018 and worked to get our feet under ourselves in terms of, well, how do you help an individual get registered to vote? What's the process? What do we need to know? So we were on a learning curve that year, mm-hmm. but have done nothing but grow since then, with the exception of COVID set us back a fair amount. But otherwise, we've been a fairly busy organization.
You said a group of people got together. Was it a response to circumstances? Did you get together like for an evening and say, you know, we should do something, and how do we do that?
The original brainstorm for an organization like this came from Bill Hogseth. At that time, he was very interested in politics and certainly as much as anything in maintaining a country where every voice could be heard. And the group started with several organizational meetings, whiteboards with opportunities to capture what we felt was important, what groups we felt we needed to reach, and how we wanted to proceed. We thought of providing rides to the polls, setting up a phone number where people could call with questions, collaborating with other groups. And ultimately, we called upon several knowledgeable people, for instance, folks that had been poll workers or had been county clerks and were familiar with the voting process to help teach us. From there, we developed, I guess, a toolkit for volunteers and a banner that said Chippewa Valley Votes. And basically began going to places where we thought we could help people get registered. We have since then gone through the process of developing a much more detailed training process for individuals that wish to feel comfortable in helping other people register to vote, and have reached out to many different organizations and settings for assisting folks.
Well, I don't know if it's irony or what it is, but since you guys started, the things that you want to accomplish are more important than ever. Removing barriers and expanding access, reducing confusion, promoting a culture of voting and civic engagement. You're in an uphill battle at the moment. Those things are all in the spotlight right now.
They are, very much so. My sense is challenges come and go, repeat themselves. So I don't think we're ever going to be in a situation where we don't find ourselves challenged to reach certain groups of people who haven't had access to the ballot, even though they are capable of being registered voters. It's our challenge to reach these groups, especially help them understand not only the process of registering to vote, but also why their vote really matters. I see education as one of the more important things that we do.
You're kind of cheerleaders too, aren't you?
Exactly. And just have a good time. Let them know that it matters. And we do. We really do enjoy that.
On the phone with Karen Voss, coordinator with a group called Chippewa Valley Votes. We should all be happy they are around. Karen, is there any kind of an official capacity to your organization? Are you tied to anything governmental, anything legal, any commissions like the Wisconsin Election Commission, or do you just work with them? What's your affiliation, if any?
We are not officially tied to any other organization. One of the more important aspects is that we are completely nonpartisan. Nonpartisanship gets us into settings like high schools, places where
You simply cannot be partisan. Everybody, no matter what their position is or what they stand for, if they're eligible to vote, they have a right to vote. And if they've never learned how to go through the process of preparing to vote, then that's what we do. Help them understand that process and feel that they're empowered to vote. We often work fairly closely with county clerks. We've actually volunteered at times to help out wherever needed. Chippewa Valley Votes is working much more closely with the League of Women Voters of the Greater Chippewa Valley. Our strengths are different, and the fact that we can work together really brings out the best of things for both organizations, I think.
You also stressed that you are not issues-based, and yet voters' rights and access have somehow become issues, and a partisan issue with that. How are you staying down the center line?
We do take positions on voter advocacy related issues. We recognize occasionally there are efforts to thwart the potential for voters to exercise their right to vote, and we take positions on that. In the first year, I think one of our strongest positions was for automatic voter registration. That would be a good example of the kind of thing that we can take a position on. We'll take positions on something that makes the process of voting more accessible, particularly to those populations that find it difficult to have access to voting.
So you brought up the word advocacy. Mm-hmm. Under the services tab on your website, one finds the word advocacy, and it reads, "We believe all voters should have a voice. Where feasible, we will work to encourage laws and rules that expand ballot access, promote participation, and reduce unreasonable obstacles to voting." The word feasible there, tell me about feasibility and how it's determined.
Feasibility is partially defined by the group we are and what our capacity is. Our capacity is primarily toward helping voters get registered and helping them fill out absentee ballots. But the advocacy part has shown up, I think, several times pretty clearly. When we started, there had been a previous effort at integrating voting more prominently into the high school curriculum for seniors who are either 18 or soon to become 18. We recognized a need to reinvigorate that process. Working with multiple high schools, starting with the Eau Claire School District and moving outward, we developed a curriculum where we could come in and work with classes, basically helping students become familiar with registering to vote. That's continued. The other advocacy has been voting for individuals who are incarcerated, retain the right to vote, but don't have access to registering if they need to or filling out an absentee ballot. This is a huge gap across all of Wisconsin. An extremely small portion of the individuals who could vote have access to the ability to vote. We have basically set the model for work all around the state right now, and the League of Women Voters particularly are helping other counties begin to go through the process of figuring out how access to the ballot can be offered to individuals who are eligible to vote but are incarcerated.
Your website, again, is just a wealth of information. It includes education and outreach. You do presentations. I'm sure people can access your website if they'd like their club or organization to have Chippewa Valley Votes do some sort of a presentation. There's a video on your website about voter registration training. It's an actual session, I believe, and you have access to a voter assistance hotline. So, man, it's a busy and important and vital website.
It's ChippewaValleyVotes.org. It helps folks connect with the information that they need in order to register to vote. Glad you brought that up. There's an email on there as well that you can contact us through.
You have pretty important jobs to do. You must be busy. And we're all applauding the fact that Chippewa Valley Votes exists. Karen Voss, thank you for being with us, and keep up the good work.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
There's free voter registration training via Zoom next Tuesday, March 1st at 6:30, sponsored by the League of Women Voters and Chippewa Valley Votes. You can register on the website lwv-gcv.org and go to the event page. Spectrum West on WPR. I'm Al Ross. Having fun today. Hope you are too. Here's a Spectrum memo. We'll have some more a little later on this Saturday night at the Stone's Throw in Eau Claire. It's the CD release party for the Sue Orfield Joan Hutton compilation, Take That Back. Speaking of fun. who we are as a society, as a world, constantly changing and coming up with things only humans can come up with. That's not just part of our culture, it is our culture, and thus fits this program like an Italian suit. Are they still renowned for being customized? Anyway, you get the metaphor. Here comes a discussion about us with Dr. Peter Hart Brinson, an associate professor of sociology, communication, and journalism at UW Eau Claire. Fascinating stuff. Let's get to know our guest a little bit. Research and teaching interests include generational change, culture, media, political communication, social movements, civic engagement, social theory, and research methods. That's a handful there. You're a graduate of UW-Madison and the New College of Florida. See, that just yells sociology to me. New College of Florida. Where is that?
New College of Florida is in Sarasota, and it really is a new college. It was founded in 1960, I believe, and it attracts people who are self-motivated, are driven, and are, I think, curious about the world. Yeah, I think that's sociology.
They said, you know, what are we going to call this school? And somebody said, why don't we call it the New College of Florida? I would love to have seen people's reactions.
Yeah, believe it or not, there is actually a new college in Oxford University in England. And so the name actually derives from that. But the educational philosophy of it is not traditional, to say the least.
Continuing our familiarization, there's some listings of things you like to do in free time. And I have to note that you like to brew beer. Being a beer guy, I think you and I have already hit it off.
Indeed. Maybe we can swap some recipes sometime.
Well, I don't brew beer. I just drink it every once in a while. That's my bubbly of choice.
Mm-hmm. Fun hobby to do to unwind on the weekend.
Good for you. Do you experiment? Because there's so many flavors nowadays.
I do, but I'm kind of a lazy home brewer. I like making it myself, but I was really terrible in chemistry class. And so given that brewing is a lot of chemistry, I don't try to get too experimental. I try to keep it simple.
Okay, so we know you now a little better. Your disciplines, social sciences, include the following: anthropology, economics, political science, sociology, and social psychology. This is all stuff that I've read. If somewhere along the line I got wrong information, don't be shy to jump in and say, well, that's a little different than what you read. Sociology is deemed the original science of society, quote unquote, having been established in the 19th century. I read the origins of sociology go back to the works of great philosophers like Aristotle and Plato and Confucius. The founders of sociology focused on addressing the challenges that emerged from modernity. And that's going to be my new favorite word. It's a derivative of modern. They witnessed and reacted to better mobility, technology advances, and it all resulted in people's exposure to societies other than their own. I'm almost done with my explanation here. The impact of this exposure, although varied, warranted demystifying traditional norms and made way for deeper explorations of how the globe works. So I want to backtrack to what I had underlined, addressing the challenges that emerged from modernity. Now, it's obvious modernity is part of our lives more now than ever because modernity continues to affect. You notice how I'm using that word a lot.
It's a great word.
Continues to affect how we live with each other more conveniently, more immediately, etc. How has the study of sociology evolved? Maybe it's evolved even in just the years you've been teaching.
Yes. In fact, I think our current moment is very similar to the rise of modernity that sociology responded to. Specifically, you know, it's worth trying to imagine what life was like in the late 1700s and early 1800s. Two big things were happening at that time in the Western world. One was the transition to democracy, I think the American Revolution. The second big thing was the rise of industrial capitalism. The Industrial Revolution had taken hold. Agrarian communities, the rural agricultural life where most people lived on farms and engaged in the subsistence lifestyle where you grew your own food, you know, made your own clothing and engaged in bartering and very basic economic exchange in the local markets. All of a sudden, that was being replaced by the rise of massive factories and the movements of people to the cities. And it was a tremendous disruption to the fabric of society. The rulers of their society were no longer monarchs and the Pope. Now they were democratically elected officials. And sociology arose in this moment where life in Western societies was being turned upside down. Mm-hmm. I think our current moment is in many ways very similar. Democracy is still here. Industrial capitalism is still here. But we are witnessing a new set of social transformations ushered in via electronic media, the rise of the internet and social media. And we are living in a moment where the old norms that old folks like me grew up with are being challenged by the new norms that young people who are growing up in the age of social media are growing up with as well.
You can understand upheaval during the emergence of technology, but who would have thought the real crossroads or the real dilemma, if you will, is basically how we use that technology rather than just its existence?
The inventors of technology often have very little clue about how their technology will ultimately come to be used, mm-hmm. or about the ultimate impacts that it has on society. When the telephone was first invented, many early members of that industry, not just the inventors, but businesses, people who were selling telephone services to cities, they thought that the telephone was far too serious and transformative to be used for such mundane purposes as calling your grandmother. They thought the telephone was so important that its use should be restricted to doctors, lawyers, and professionals, the people who were doing really serious work in society. And they actively tried to dissuade people from having telephones installed in their homes. Little did they know, the market would ask otherwise, and telephones would become an instrument of ordinary sociability. So it is absolutely true. Technologies are let loose in the world, and we as people oftentimes find uses for them the founders never imagined.
Before we knew it, we had the party line.
That's right. And the party line is hard to imagine for a lot of young folks today.
But talk about a sociological petri dish.
That's right.
Peter Hart Brinson, Associate Professor of Sociology and Communication and Journalism at UW-Eau Claire. We are talking about who we are, why we are who we are, who we might be becoming, etc. Peter, early sociologists sought to answer some key questions like, what exactly holds together social groups, and what are the possible solutions to social solidarity breakdown? Are those questions always being asked in your field of study?
Those kinds of questions are continually being asked, but those aren't the only ones. So there are other questions that have arisen as well. Mm-hmm. The reason why those questions are still being asked today is because as societies change, we see new threats to social order and social solidarity. And as groups evolve and change, the effects that they have on other groups in society around them also evolve and change. The easiest way to think about it, society is constantly generating new dynamics and new tensions within itself that causes everyone around the society to continually adjust. How does society hang together is a question that's continually being asked because the environment in which we all live is continually being remade.
I have to point out now, because you are kind of an authority on these kinds of things, in my more cynical moments, and they're coming more frequently lately, I'm hoping it's just the curmudgeon factor. I am of the opinion that as a society, we are possibly too connected. We say too much, and we know too much about one another, and the culprit could be the impulsiveness that we're able to display given the technology. We're not thinking about or pondering things, which is a good and vital process in my mind that, is designed to filter and confirm things, at least internally and prior to shouting it to the mountaintops. We're too quick with the send button. How much of an effect is that phenomenon having on society?
I think it's having a huge effect on society. The way I've come to think about it is that the little devices that we all carry around in our pockets, those smartphones that are simultaneously computers and email clients and telephones and video game players and music players and video cameras and ways to connect to the entire world. I mean, those little devices are extremely powerful, and it transfers their power onto us as an individual. So social media and the internet have empowered ordinary people to communicate with the world, to engage with the world in the ways that would have only been part of the wildest science fiction fantasy 100 years ago.
You're right.
And so given that we all have this incredible power that we carry around with us in our pocket, there our sphere of influence, the range of people and the number of people that we can influence by our actions has extended to the length that nobody prior to this generation was prepared for. You know, I'm part of the old generation where my 10th grade English class that required me to write a research paper on something, it was a special weekend trip to the library to flip through a card catalog and find a piece of paper, to find a book, to take it off the shelf, to sit there in the library and look it up and find that very difficult to find information. You know, engaging with the world of information and social influence was a very limited and difficult thing to do back then. Nowadays, information is so prevalent and so easy to get, and it is so easy to interact with others, even people who live around the world, that the skills that I learned going to the library and looking in those precious encyclopedias really just don't match with the kinds of skills that people in this generation need to develop. And if I haven't been trained how to wield these technologies and how to engage in the world of information, then who is training these folks?
The moment you said the word information, I was putting it in quotation marks on my notes, because we, you know, we can't always be assured that it's the information that that we need.
Right. You know, in our age, in the 20th century, the difference was between being informed and being uninformed. You either had information and it was good information, or you didn't have that good information. Nowadays, we have a new problem. We have this problem of misinformation. And so it is better to be uninformed than it is to be misinformed.
There you go. Yeah.
There's a new danger in our world that we just didn't experience in the 20th century. Mm-hmm. No one in the 20th century took seriously the idea that the earth is flat. But now people do. And it's an illustration of the fact that this new media universe that we live in is creating these new challenges for us as a society. How do we make our society work? If the difference between a good society is one in which, you know, people are informed, and a bad society is one in which people are not informed.
Yes.
Now, how do we make this society work when we have this new threat of misinformation, or even worse, disinformation, where powerful people are deliberately sowing false information into the media ecosystem?
Any opinion on how we find a way back to things like live and let live and to each his own and other slogans that have crashed and burned lately? I mean, we all have opinions about everybody else and each other, and we think that our opinions are right and our group's opinions are right. We used to say live and let live and to each his own, and we would just go about our daily lives.
Sure.
We don't do that as well anymore.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. Back in the 1960s, there was
which I'm very familiar with, by the way.
Well, I'm about to say something that you might not be familiar with. There was a media theorist in Canada named Marshall McLuhan. He prophesied the world of the 20th century, the late 20th century, and the 21st century would become a world that he characterized as a global village. And he thought the emergence of electronic communication technologies, so think like television and other electronic technologies, would connect us more closely than ever before, make the boundaries of society global. You know, we would all be sort of stitched together, you know, in one network of communication.
Sounds familiar.
Sounds familiar, right? Here's the interesting part. He used the phrase global village because he imagined that this global society would not be a modern cosmopolitan society like we think of ourselves. He imagined this global village as being one in which we were all sort of tribal again, that the society was composed not of cosmopolitan individuals becoming global citizens or something like that. He thought that we would all sort of re-tribalize into these very small, like-minded communities where individual free thought and individual free expression would disappear under the pressure of group conformity. He was not even imagining anything close to the internet when he made this prophecy, but in some ways, the internet has brought that prophecy into being. Online, it's wonderful because we can now find communities of like-minded people. No matter how much of an oddball or how unique you might be, you can go on the internet and find people who are just like you. And that's a wonderful thing in so many ways. But I think part of the unintended consequence of that is that we are now starting to develop communities only on the basis of shared interests. And it's harder to make communities out of diversity. And so the challenge for us, I think, is to take these new powers that we have via our smartphones and the social media platforms that we routinely log on to. And we have to choose how to use those powers in ways that balance both the comfort of being around people who are like yourselves and the discomfort and the growth that comes from being around people who you're different from. Mm-hmm. And I think we have to do that as a society. We have to seek out diversity of opinion. We have to seek out diversity of experience.
How often, though, do we hear we have to and we have to and we have to? That's all true. But who's going to lead us there?
That's right. Well, you can't legislate this. No government can make a policy that forces us to do this. And of course, you can't solve your way out of the problem with technology, because like we said earlier, technological inventions have a way of being turned to uses that are very different from ones that they were intended. So when we say we have to do this, it's ultimately us that has to make this decision. It's a collective problem, and each person's decision matters. Now, we can't guarantee success, and we can't guarantee that society is going to, you know, evolve in a direction that we would like it to, but that is the nature of society.
We isn't a word that we use a lot today. A lot of I.
Yes, in a way. Yeah. There's always a balance between I, the individual, and we, the group. That balance between individual freedom and collective responsibility has to be there to preserve the society, the kind of society that is enjoyable for most people to live in.
Sociology is the study of the we. What would it be? Psychology? Psychiatry would be the study of the I?
I like to think of psychology as being the study of the world through the inside out, starting with the I and looking at how the I, you know, projects out into the world. Sociology is the study of the world from the outside in. How all the groups and organizations and forces around us kind of creep in and impact what each of us says and does.
I knew you'd say it much better than I did somehow. Peter Hart Brinson, it's fascinating. And again, I wish we had more time. We are going to make more time for this down the road. Thank you so much for being with us on WPR.
Thank you very much. It's been great talking to you.
Got some time for a Spectrum memo or two? I do. The Bias Inside Us, the traveling Smithsonian exhibit, opens Saturday at Pablo Center in the James W. Hansen Gallery. It's open from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. Monday through Saturday and during evening performances. PabloCenter.org. Tickets for this year's Viennese Ball at UW Eau Claire now on sale. It's back in person April 8th and 9th. Tickets at uwec.universitytickets.com.
the Foster Gallery at UW Eau Claire in partnership with UW Eau Claire's Institute for Health Sciences presents Body Parts, an exhibition exploring six body organs through the lens of art. It's up through March 9th. That's good stuff. Hey, next week, we're going to visit a popular area gallery and talk about others. We might get to know a guy named Ross who plays the cello pretty well. Weird Fest is on the way, plus a lot more. In the meantime, keep in touch. Thanks, Rick. Thanks, Kate. Thank you all for being a part of this experience. Please come back every chance you get. It's called Spectrum West. I'm Al Ross. See ya.